2014, and it is about 12 minutes after. So let the record reflect that present today is Representative Johnson, Representative Hawker, Representative Olson, and Representative Seaton, and myself, Vice Chair Wilson. And I'd like to recognize staffers today. We have Julie Kohler, who is our House Recording Secretary, and Thatcher Brower is our LIO monitor. And committee aides are Kim Skipper and Trevor Fulton. And before we start, please turn off your cell phones or else put them on airplane mode. And today's agenda, we have two bills. One bill will be Senate Joint Resolution 15, which opposes the international designating of lands, and House Bill 287, approved Tesoro royalty oil sale. And we have four confirmation hearings, and if we don't get all of these done today, we'll hope we'll get to them on Friday. What, you're going to have a meeting for Wednesday? Okay, on Wednesday. As usual, the staff knows all these details better than the rest of us. So anyway, so up first, we're going to have Senate Joint Resolution 15. And I believe Senator Diesel, if you would like to come forward. And I believe we have a committee substitute. Is that correct? Version U. Is there a motion to move that before the committee? Representative Hawker.
No, Madam Chairman, I move that the committee adopts Senate Joint Resolution Number 15, Version 28-LS-1192/U uniform as our working document.
Okay. Thank you.
Objection.
Okay, we have an objection.
And I just want to get clarification whether U or N was the version that's being brought forward to us.
Jane Conway, staff to Senator Giesel. The current version now of the CS would be version N. We're going from U to N.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So
we're going from...
The original version was U, umbrella. The motion just now was for N, November.
The motion was for U. I heard the request from the chair was the uniform version.
Yeah. And
I withdraw my motion, ma'am.
Okay. Motion's been removed. But let's just take a brief of these. An N before us.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
I'd move to bring House Committee substitute for Joint Resolution Number 15, Version N, before the committee as a working document.
Okay. Any objections?
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay. There's been an objection. And Senator Diesel, would you explain your resolution and the changes in the CS? And let the record show that Representative Tarr and Representative Kawasaki have joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'm going to have Jane Conway, my staff, go through the changes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jane Conway. I am staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. Version N that you have before you is there are three very small changes in this CS. Page 2, line 26, changed the words National Park Service to the federal government. Page 3, line 8, changed the word would to potentially could evolve into. And on page 4, line 6, change the word would to could. Pretty simple changes there.
Okay. And changes that really don't, those are little technical changes?
Okay. Madam Chair, those changes do not at all alter the message of SJR 15.
Okay. Okay. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I'll remove my objection to the adoption of the CS.
Okay. Now we have the CS before us. And do we have any questions of the sponsor? See no questions. Is there any public testimony at all? Okay, I would like to open public testimony. And I'm sure I will get a list pretty quick here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Could we get a highlight of the bill for people online so that everybody, so that the bill's been introduced to the listening
okay.
public?
Yes. Go ahead and Senator, if you would give us your version of exactly what this bill does, or what this resolution does.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel. I represent District N, November. That's the South Anchorage Hillside, all of Turnagain Arm, and the north half of the Kenai Peninsula. Senate Joint Resolution 2015, thank you, I've got the wrong number there, is very similar to a resolution that actually members of this committee, a couple members of this committee, sponsored in 2007 and was passed at that time. This is not a new issue. Beringia is an international park designation up in western Alaska, northwestern Alaska. Now, you might ask, so what? Why should we care about an international designation? Well, this represents another taking of Alaska land. You all are familiar with ANILCA, of course. This is the Resource Committee. Of course, you understand the National Interest Lands Conservation Act. And in that act, in the third element, it indicated that Alaska had given its share of lands for federal conservation units, and there was a no more clause in it. Alaska need give no more land. Yet after that was passed in 1985, the National Park Service began to capture land to create the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve, taking more land. Shortly after that, they began in the early 90s an informal discussion between President Bush and President Gorbachev of Russia proposing an international park designation. Some land on the Russian side, some Alaska land. In 2013, the government of Russia formally established the Beringia National Park on the Chukotka Peninsula on their side. This would be joined with the Beringia Land Bridge National Preserve on the Seward Peninsula and Cape Krusenstein, which is a national monument just north of Kotzebue. So this would be then Russian land and Alaskan land creating a international park designation. In October 13, so that was just October of 2013, so that was about 4 or 5 months ago, another MOU, Memorandum of Understanding between the U.S. and Russia, was developed, and it's now waiting for signature from our president to finalize this international designation. So the purpose of this international park is to preserve culture and look at the environment and do research and so forth. It's a protected area. It all sounds really nice. However, our governor has not been part of these discussions. You and I have not been part of these discussions, and Congress also has not been invited to discuss or chime in on this designation. This designation falls under the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. After Cape Krusenstein National Monument and the Bering Sea Land Bridge National Preserve designations, we have seen further UN organization criteria applied to our other areas. For example, Eisenbeck is a Ramsar site. We had a road proposed to go through Eisenbeck recently, declined. Concern about the grasses there and the birds. This is a Ramsar site designated under the United Nations. We also have World Heritage Sites. These are also UN designations, Glacier Bay, Wrangell St. Elias. We have biosphere reserves. Did you know that Denali National Park is a biosphere reserve designated by the United Nations? There is an ongoing push for a buffer zone around Denali National Park. This is a common stage step in after designating a biosphere reserve. This is one of the steps to expand the size of a reserve such as this. So these UN designations, you might say, well, they sound, you know, meaningless enough, and why should we worry about it? Well, actually, these designations have curtailed resource development around the world in areas even outside of these designated areas. So this resolution is expressing my concern, and previously members of this committee's concern, that terms such as sustainable development and things like that that are commonly stated by the United Nations and our federal government actually will mean restricted development. The governor has sent letters to Secretary of State Clinton expressing his concern. Senator Murkowski and Congressman Young have asked Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell and Secretary of State Kerry to stop and to listen to the state of Alaska on this issue. Our majority leadership over in the other body has written a similar letter. And CACFA, the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, has listed this international park as a primary priority concern. So that's the purpose of this resolution, Madam Chair, to raise people's awareness that this proposal has not gone away. In fact, it's moved forward. We now have an MOU signed by Russia and the Secretary of the Interior. We're now, Secretary of State, and we're now waiting for President Obama's signature on it, which will make it a done deal. So with that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Madam. Representative Hawker, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this may be a little bit of a nit, but looking at the structure of this, we get into the be it resolves, and you know, we all know what a resolution like this is. It's a strongly worded letter from our branch of government to another branch of government. We go through all the further resolves to the very end there, the last one, which all the previous ones arguably are sending our letter to federal agencies of some sort. And of course, we've got the copies at the bottom, but mine's 14 to 19, the final further resolved. It's really being addressed to the governor and the attorney general of the state of Alaska, and I see they are not officially copied on the resolution. I'm just wondering if that ought to be considered, or if there's a, am I missing something?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, good suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it, ma'am.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for bringing this forward. Senator, can you give me a specific example of where this particular classification has exactly hampered the use of development of natural resources within our state? I didn't see it in any of the backup.
Absolutely. In fact, I'll let my staff, Jane, go through that sheet. There are numerous documents in your binder, but she'll illuminate some of them specifically.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I think your question was in this state or in other states? Please, for clarification.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think it said, I'm looking at some of the further resolves, just mentioning this state, I think it is.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I think the one that's most currently on our minds is the recent rejection of the road from Coal Bay to King Sam and the Eisenbeck Road. One that was clearly cited as being a Ramsar site as one of the reasons for denial for that road, and it cited the black-headed brant and the protection of eelgrass that is in that area. So that would be one of the most recent. But I think the purpose of this resolution is that it could possibly hamper various developments in the state if we allow these international designations to be designated without our approval or Congress approval.
Okay. I've got another question.
Follow-up?
It's a separate question, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
specifically dealing with the memorandum of understanding regarding Beringia. I mean, aren't there I think you started to talk a little bit about some of the benefits, but can you tell me just some of those benefits that are potentially out there from having an actual MOU in place where the state of Alaska, the federal government knows, and where they stand in reference to Russia, the other partner?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I can't think of a single benefit for us having this MOU in place. We have given lots of land to conservation areas in Alaska. This is an additional taking which would put it under the United Nations, an international taking, if you will, and I see no benefit to it.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to understand the land holdings with the two maps that were provided for us in the packet here. So the brown line on this one shows proposed contributions to international protected area. And so these areas on the Seward Peninsula, I just wanted to make sure I understood, are those, they appear from the other map to be all federal and native land, so in that sense it's proper that the federal government would be having these deliberations because they're federal lands. Are there some state lands included?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, great question. So yes, these are, I'm going to hold up this map that is green. It just shows the Bering Straits, essentially. Okay. So we've got the Bering Bridge, Land Bridge Park here, International Park here, and we've got the Prusenstein up here further north of Kotzebue. Then over here on the other side, you see the Russia-designated lands. Here's the challenge with this. If you go to the National Park Service website, I'm going to hold up the other map now that shows the federal lands, and I'm only going to use this illustratively. If you go to the National Park Service website, they describe Beringia by latitude and longitude and geographic location. Mm-hmm. Beringia, the area designated, actually goes across the very top of Alaska over here to the Mackenzie River, which is over in Canada. It's where this box is with the color coding. Mm-hmm. Then it comes all the way down here to the bottom of the Kamchatka. Yes, I don't even have a map of that, but the Kamchatka Peninsula, mm-hmm, that comes right out here in Russia, which is about parallel to the end of the Aleutians. So it essentially encompasses our entire state. Mm-hmm. Across the top here, of course, is we have significant resources. We've got oil. Mm-hmm. We've got mining. To build the road that went from the Red Dog Mine to Tidewater had to cross over Cape Krusenstein. Mm-hmm. It required an act of Congress to go across that land. Mm-hmm. If this becomes internationally designated, what barriers will we have to resource development? Mm-hmm. That's the concern. This is a slippery slope we need to be aware of and speak out against.
A follow-up, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's this particular outline, with the exception of that example, isn't as problematic as the overall larger designation is more of the concern.
Thank you, Representative Tarr, through the chair. These designations tend to expand over time. In addition, as I said, this is U.S. land. Why would we give it up to international, mm-hmm, jurisdiction?
Any other Madam questions? Chair. Okay, then we will go to off-net. And we have Stan Lippart, who is with the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Lands in Fairbanks. Stan, would you identify yourself and who you're speaking for, and then give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stan Lippart. I'm the Executive Director for the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of SJR 15. The Commission shares the concerns expressed in SGR 15 regarding the designation of lands under various international initiatives, such as that reflected in the proposed Memorandum of Understanding between the United States and the Russian Federation to symbolically link national parks, U.S. national parks, and the Bering Strait region to form an international protected area. The proposed MOU states that it is legally non-binding and is not an international agreement. It does not create any rights or obligations under international law. Based on past experience, however, the terms of this MOU could complicate the ability of the National Park Service to manage the national parklands in this region, and it could also potentially affect the ability of the state of Alaska and the private landowners in the region to develop and utilize lands that they own. While somewhat different in scope, Senator Giesel mentioned this, but while somewhat different in scope, the recent decision by the Secretary of the Interior to not approve the construction of a road in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge was based in no small part on the 1986 designation of the refuge as a wetland of international importance, the Ramsar Convention. Even though the convention is non-regulatory and has no sanctions for violating treaty commitments, this was a key element in the Secretary's decision to deny construction of that road. In the 1990s, the designation of Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve as both a United Nations World Heritage Site and a Biosphere Reserve was a factor in the phased elimination of 100-year-old state-managed commercial fisheries in the park. The Commission does note that the National Park Service Shared Beringian Heritage Program has funded numerous projects over the last 12 years in the Bering Straits region. These projects have collected useful archaeological, cultural, historical, and natural resource and environmental data. We also note that many of the projects that were undertaken utilizing National Park Service funds did not take place in the Alaskan Park units for which the National Park Service has statutory management responsibility, but took place within the Russian Federation. Both the Cape Krusenstern National Monument and the Bering Landbridge National Preserve, which are the two national park units that would be symbolically linked under this MOU, were created by NLCA to protect archaeological sites, provide for the study of historic migration of peoples across the Bering Straits, as well as to preserve natural and cultural resources of these two areas. We believe that the increasingly scarce funds used for the administratively created Shared Beringian Heritage Program could best be utilized to meet the National Park Service's statutory responsibilities for these two park units. I would also like to point out that even though ostensibly under the MOU, the management decisions would only directly affect the national park units, I want to read a short excerpt from a recently released report by the Science Committee of the National Park System Advisory Board. It states that NPS management strategies must be expanded to encompass a geographic scope beyond park ground boundaries to larger landscapes and to consider longer time horizons. Specific tactics include improving the representation of unique ecosystem types within the national park system, prioritizing the protection of habitats that may serve as climate refugia, ensuring the maintenance of critical migration and dispersal corridors, and strengthening the resilience of park ecosystems. Madam Chair, I would submit that this language and this report recommend that the National Park Service look outside its boundaries to develop management strategies, emphasizes the possible threat from creation of this Beringian heritage area. So with that, I'll conclude by saying that the Commission does support SCR 15 and the concerns that it expresses.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for Stan? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. The first few sentences you spoke about the MOU being non-binding, and I'm just wondering if that's the document that, you know, that indicates things are moving forward. Is this resolution going to have any impact on this? I guess this is, you know, saying opposition to any designations, but it's not directly addressing the MOU, which is the document that's moving forward, and I guess I'm just wondering if that's the intent, if it should address the MOU.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I believe that my reading of the resolution would certainly affect whether or not hopefully the president signs or doesn't sign this MOU, because this is actually the vehicle that would more or less formalize the relationship that now exists sort of informally between the National Park Service, the U.S. federal government, and the Russian Federation. So I think the intent, my understanding of the intent, would be that it would be in opposition to this MOU.
Okay, thank you very much. Seeing no
thank
other...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Stan, very much. Next, we'll go to Bientha Crockett, who is in Anchorage. And Bientha, if you can give your name and your affiliation and your testimony.
Thank you, Representative. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bientha Crockett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. AME has been around since 1939, and we celebrate our 75th anniversary this year. We're the umbrella association for Alaska's mining industry, and our members include small family-run placer operations to the large-scale hard rock mines, coal mines, exploration projects, and all vendors and contractors that support Alaska's mines. AME does not support actions that decrease or prevent access to Alaska's land. In 1980, and I know the Senator Kiesel went over this, but I would like to reiterate that ANOCA did promise no more land would be precluded from multiple use, fully accessible classifications. The federal government today should keep that promise, AMA believes, and block no further acreage from access, exploration, and hopefully development of all uses. Separately, we think land designations should only be made with full congressional approval with the Alaska legislature and with the governor, as well as the various private landowners in this area. We know that Governor Parnell, as well as Senator Murkowski and Congressman Young, have expressed concerns that the federal government has not consulted with the state on this land designation. I think, you know, technically, designations like this don't create regulatory authority over lands, but it is a consideration taken into account by the land managers who evaluate activities in these areas, and it's certainly noticed by developers who may sense additional risk by these land designations when they're evaluating whether or not to invest in Alaska. AMA believes that the passage of SJR 15 will send a message that our state lawmakers take the multiple use standard seriously, and that designation of lands within our state must be done in consultation with the state. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Don't see any questions, so thank you so much. And now we'll go to Marliana Hall in Anchorage. And Marliana, if you can state your name and your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Marliana Hall. I'm a projects coordinator for the Resource Development Council. I'm calling in today to testify in support of the committee substitute for SJR 15. RDC is a membership-funded statewide business association representing forestry, oil and gas, mining, tourism, and fishing industries. It is a policy of RDC to advocate for access to and across lands in Alaska for resource and community development. RDC is concerned that the proposed Memorandum of Understanding for the creation of the Beringia International Park will create yet another level of bureaucracy inhibiting access to areas in Alaska. Additionally, this bill, we note, is timely, given that the MOU is yet to be signed by the President. Input from those most knowledgeable about Alaska and Alaska's resources should not be ignored. The MOU could seriously jeopardize the ability to access resources that fall in and around Beringia. In addition, past federal government promises assured access to allow resource development in this area and others not set aside through ANILCA, as Santa mentioned. The passage of ANILCA in 1980 withdrew 106 million acres of federal lands in Alaska into conservation system units. And today, Alaska accounts for 70% of all national park lands in the United States, as well as some 53% of federally designated wilderness. RDC encourages the committee to pass the committee substitute SJR 15 out of House resources and we thank you for your consideration of our comments.
Okay, thank you very much, Marlena. And any questions? Don't see any, so thank you very much. And is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And now, is there any more committee discussion?
Under discussion, General?
Yeah. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think a lot of us took the mega project seminar several years ago, and I thought it was really enlightening to understand, you know, that part of the problem when we're talking about development is having developers or prospective developers know kind of what the confines are in their development. And sometimes MOUs do have a positive impact. I'm not really sure about this one in particular. I don't have an objection to moving it out at this point, but I just wanted to lay that on the record.
Okay. Anyone else? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just wanted to point out that in the final further resolved, you know, we talked about notifying the governor, but there's also urging the Attorney General to reserve all legal remedies, and I think that's a very important part of this.
Okay. Representative Hawker?
Madam Chair, if it's right with you at this point in time, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number one.
Okay.
And, yeah. Ma'am, that would be to add the governor, Parnell, and Attorney General Garrity to the addressees of the resolution. And if you would object so I could make a comment.
Okay. I object so that you can state the reasons.
Thank you very kindly. And again, I had a note back from another member here that said, well, we maybe not don't really need to because it is a resolution and it goes past the governor's desk for signature, but respectfully, yeah. Just that it's going past his desk for signature doesn't mean that the governor officially gets it by assimilation, and especially the Attorney General's office. So I'd like to make it very clear, and with the sponsor's consent, make the conceptual amendment to add Governor Parnell and Attorney General Garrity to the addressees of the letter.
And I see the bill or the resolution sponsor shaking her head yes. So
great amendment. Thank you.
And so I will remove my objection, and we have that motion on the table. Does anybody see no objection? So moved. So we have moved conceptual amendment number one. Do we have anything else? Representative Olson.
Chair.
Yes.
I move to report out of committee the CS for SJR 15 version N as amended with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendation. And as amended with the conceptual amendment.
All right. Seeing no objection, so moved. And we'll take a short recess while we quickly sign up our papers, sign the papers. And now we will take up our confirmation hearings. We have four of them, and we'll do each one individually. And we'll start with Michelle Metz with the Big Game Commercial Services Board. And Michelle, are you online?
I am, Madam Chair.
Michelle, if you could just kind of start out and tell us why you want to see. You are you on there now?
I am. This would be a reappointment.
Okay, if you could just go into why you want to be reappointed and then a little bit about what you do, and then we will go ahead and see if there are questions from the committee.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I serve as the lessons manager for the Sea Alaska Corporation based out of Juneau. And this would be a reappointment, my first reappointment to this board. I think I served part of a term the first time. And it's a lot of learning. There's a lot of information. I was recommended to sit on this board or recommended for the governor to appoint me by the former chair of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. That was Paul Johnson. And I occupy a seat as a large private landowner. We have had and have currently guides operating on CLS to land, and one of the reasons I'm interested in being involved is because this is a good employment opportunity in the rural community. Seasonal, it can be workaround subsistence. A lot of our folks are familiar with the outdoors and hunting and those kinds of things. So it seems to be a natural fit to get them some kind of meaningful employment and job, whether they're acting as assistant guides for a guide or working their way in as a guide to do this. So, I guess that's it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Well, Michelle, I don't see any questions at all. So, I guess we will go ahead and see if we have a motion then.
Public testimony?
Public testimony?
There isn't any. There wasn't any public testimony. There might be. Okay. None on the line?
And, Madam Chair, just a point, maybe just as a formality, you might want to officially open and officially close public testimony.
Okay. So I'll open public testimony, but seeing that there is none, is there any?
There's none.
And there's none online, and there is none in the room. So what is the will of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hawker.
Madam Chair, I move that the committee forward the name of Michelle Metz as nominee to the Big Game Commercial Services Board.
Okay, so it has been moved that Michelle's reappointment to the Big Game Commercial Services Board will be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Are there hearing no objections? So moved. So, and we have to sign those separately.
Yeah, we'll sign.
Yeah. Briefities. Okay. Then we will go ahead, and the next next one that we up is the let's see. The next one is the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and that is. Yes, I will go back to the beginning here. That is Jean Peltola. And Jean, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm online.
Okay, well, go ahead and give us your calling from Bethel.
I'm calling from Bethel. As with Michelle, I'm a reappointment. I served the remaining year of a prior three-year term, and I was originally nominated by the current chairman of the Commercial Services Big Game Guide Board. I just retired after 24 years of being president and CEO of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, and I've always had an interest in natural resources, and this state has been good to me, and I want to be able to, in my retirement, provide services back to the state of Alaska.
Believe me, I can handle it.
Okay, wonderful reasons. Any comments from the committee? Any questions from the committee? I don't see any. We will open public testimony. And is there anyone that that's online that would like to testify? Okay, and is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, do I have, I'll close public testimony, and do I have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hawker.
Madam Chair, I move that the name of Jean Peltola be forwarded, as a nominee for the Big Game Commercial Services Board, be forwarded to a joint legislative session for confirmation. Madam Chair, I've also been asked that make it very clear on the record that forwarding any of these names by this committee is neither a commitment to vote for or against the individual by any member of this committee.
And that is so true, because we do our voting when we get to the floor with a joint session. So having no objections, your motion has been moved.
Thank you, ma'am.
So congratulations, Gene. And
thank you.
Okay. Next on the agenda is the governor's appointee of Fritz Johnson to the Board of Fisheries. And, Mr. Johnson, you're also calling from Dillingham. And are you there?
Yes, I am, Madam Chairman.
Okay. Please put your name on the record and give us a quick review of your qualifications and tell us why you'd like to serve on the Board of Fisheries.
Thank you. Thank you much. My name is Fritz Johnson, the governor's designee for the MPC on the Alaska Board of Fisheries. Bristol Bay is my home, which, as you know, is fish country, like much of Alaska. It's been my home since 1979 when I started fishing commercially here, and every season since then I've either crewed or captained on various boats for salmon, herring, and to a lesser extent, halibut. But my first winter job here was working for the 1980 federal census, when I had a chance to visit virtually every community in the region from Pedro Bay to the Chignicks, and I got to know the people and I got to know the region. I also spent a dozen years managing a weekly newspaper here from 1980 till 1992, and really became familiar with the whole universe of issues important to Southwest Alaska. Between fishing seasons, I've done media work for various nonprofits. But 5 years ago, I signed on as the regional fisheries coordinator for the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, the local community development quota entity in our part of the state, in a job that, much like the work of the Board of Fisheries, is all fish all the time. I'm familiar with board processes and procedures, and I hold elected director seats on the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association and our local telephone and electric utility. And I'm ready to make the commitment of time and the direction to the Board of Fisheries mandate for sustainability of Alaska's fisheries while providing opportunity to the various user groups and in the state. And with that, I guess I'm happy to answer any questions you or the committee may have.
Okay, thank you very much. And Representative Hawker.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, thank you very much for throwing your hat into this ring. Boy, I tell you what, I got to admire anybody that's willing to go for the Board of Fish. I've got strong support for you here in my hands and letters of support from commercial fishermen's groups. I guess the question I would have for you is just an honest comment from you. Do you feel that as a member of the Board of Fish, you can fairly represent all user groups beyond just the commercial fisheries? That, of course, would be the sport fish side as well as the com fish side of these issues.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, sir, I wouldn't be applying for this position if I didn't feel I could do that. I've been known to carry a fishing rod around myself on occasion and have a long history in that. But although my principal background in Bristol Bay is in commercial fishing, I recognize that the Board of Fisheries is mandated to protect all our fisheries and provide opportunity to all the various user groups.
And thank you. That's really all I can ask of you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Jarre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to avoid the unfortunate situation we had at the end of session last year, we have letters of support, but just so we can get it on the record, are there any groups that you're aware of that are opposing your position as, to be appointed to the and confirmed to the Board of Fisheries? And just in the interest of full disclosure, to cover that issue right now.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, not that I'm aware of. However, I have participated in seven Board of Fisheries meetings, since October, and I'm realizing that it's not always happy to make, or it's always not always possible to make everyone happy in this regard. But at the present time, no, I'm not aware of any particular user group that, shall I say, has taken a dislike to me.
Okay, thank you very much, and That's always a good sign. Okay. I'll open up to public testimony. Is there anyone that would like to testify online? Is there anyone that would like to testify in the room? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And what is the will of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hawker.
And before I make a motion, if I just might say that the silence during public testimony screamed volumes about this gentleman's qualifications to be on this board. So with that, Madam Chair, I move that the committee forward the name of Frederick Johnson to the joint session for further confirmation to the position on the Board of Fisheries. And again, I'd also note that us forwarding that name is neither a commitment to vote for or against that individual by anyone on this committee.
Okay. Hearing no objections, so moved. So we will briefly now take a recess so we can sign the papers. On line here. Next on the agenda is the governor's appointee of Joe Balash as the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And Joe, if you'd come forward and give us a brief summary of why and a little bit about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, commissioner designee for the Department of Natural Resources. And Alaska has been my home since 1986. We moved up here as a family. My father was in the Air Force. We were stationed at Eielson Air Force Base, and it truly is my home. This is where I want to be. This is where I want to raise my family, and this is where I want to die. And you know, it was 17 sessions ago that I first worked in this building, and I've had the opportunity to see any number of events come and go, and one thing that I have learned is that DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, is the premier agency in state government in terms of what makes this state go, what brings in the money, what allows us to do all that is so spectacular here in Alaska. And so it's really an honor and a privilege for me to have an opportunity to lead this particular agency with the responsibilities that come with it. We've got more than 100 million acres of uplands, 60 million plus more in tidelands, submerged lands, and you know, it's a really big job. We've got world-class resources, as members of this committee are well aware, and it requires world-class management. And I could not possibly hope to do this job without the fine men and women that staff our agency through our multiple divisions, more than 1,100 of them. And you know, I really see the job of those people as managing the resources on a day-to-day basis, and the commissioner and the commissioner's office really functioning as an asset manager rather than a resource manager. I think that the people who sit in this chair and the deputies alongside really need to be looking at ways to leverage the resources we have, the assets we have, to create additional value, additional opportunity. We have plenty of people out there on the front lines who have the day-to-day responsibilities to follow the regs, to follow the procedures, and issue the permits on a daily basis. But if the people sitting here don't keep an eye out for that opportunity, I think we're selling ourselves short. And maybe a couple of examples would help illustrate that particular approach or philosophy. One of those is in the Division of Parks. We have the largest park system in the United States, and it's one that I think we should all be quite proud of. Yet, we have a backlog of deferred maintenance in those parks that exceeds $50 million. And our ability to overcome that backlog is limited by all the same budget challenges that this body has to wrestle with at present. So what can we do about that? Well, I think there is an untapped opportunity in our parks today. And I think the legislature has taken some steps to get started on an approach that really could be the key here, and that is identifying private concessions that can be leveraged to create revenue streams. And an example of that is in South Denali, where we have started on the road of developing a new alternative as opposed to the Glitter Gulch experience in Denali National Park, to provide a visitor opportunity that we could partner with the visitor industry on, and really in the form of a long-term concession and agreement, create a revenue stream that we could plow back into parks. And importantly, not just the high-traveled, high-density, high-activity parks, but I'm talking about the ones that our families use, where we go for picnics and barbecues and weekend campouts. I think that's something that we need to complete at South Denali, and we need to look for the next opportunity. And I think Chugach State Park, there's got to be an opportunity there that's worth pursuing in this sort of fashion. And then further out in Wood Tick Chick, I think there's got to be a similar kind of opportunity to really make sure we're not doing anything that's inconsistent with the park values or park management, but having a controlled, planned, and orderly method for visitors to come and see these treasures, and at the same time create that revenue stream that can help sustain that park system for all of us. On the oil and gas front, I think we've spent a lot of time in this room in particular talking about how it is we can leverage the existing proven resource base that we have at Prudhoe Bay to create additional opportunities for years to come in developing additional potential resource. But what I'd like to do there is point out somewhere, a place that I think we got it wrong. And in that particular instance, what I'm talking about are the developments at Alpine and Badami. They were developed without roads. And we did that, and we were all happy to see Alpine and Badami developed. But what we missed out on was extending our reach. We are limited in our exploration efforts by the radius of ice roads that can extend out beyond the existing year-round infrastructure. And so we now face the exact same radius we had in 1989, and yet we should be able to reach that much further, both east and west. And that's something that, I think is a shame. I think it's something that's probably cost us opportunities as a state in the last 20 years. So those are the kinds of things that I would hope to be able to avoid. And one thing that I don't think any of you would necessarily ask me about, but I've heard some rumblings in the public about my age, my experience, and I don't see that as a problem, but let me explain why. The reality is that I'm young enough that I know I'm going to see the consequences of the decisions that are made in this chair, and that's something that weighs on me heavily, and something that I take as an incredible responsibility, and be happy to answer any further questions that the committee has, or answer specific details about my background or anything else, although I think most of the people here know me pretty well.
I have a question, and as far as with Alpine and Padami, when you said we should be expanding, now are you talking about more ice roads, or are you talking about maybe some permanent roads? What are you talking about?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think in this particular case, we developed those fields without permanent roads. Had we included permanent roads, then our reach with the ice roads would be much further out than they are today. And we're seeing now the development of Point Thompson, which is fortunately a large enough field that the operator and the working interest owners can afford to pursue that development without a road. They've had to do it with ice roads and limited access seasonally. I think we're fortunate that that field is that big and worthy of that kind of investment. And what I think we miss out on are the smaller opportunities. The home runs will take care of themselves. But what we need as a state is to string together a few base hits.
I think you're right. Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that. And Joe, it's really good to see you in this chair at the moment. Been a long time. And I want to preface the question I want to ask you with just one. I know you well enough to know I really do appreciate the passion you bring to this job, the experience, quite frankly, the intelligence you bring to it. And also, I know your very, very deep commitment to your duty. I mean, that's something that was ingrained in you by your family. But I'd like to turn that into a question.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, over the dozen years that we've worked together here and through a lot of ups and downs and a lot of challenging issues, certainly you also personally have, and I use the word, the appearance of being extremely close to the folks over at TransCanada. Seems a little almost a little odd to me here that, like, the one person sitting in our gallery happens to be TransCanada's lobbyist outside of our recurring staff and one other old guy back there in the corner. which makes me, you know, phrase a question. What's their interest in your confirmation? And so I have to honestly ask you, and, you know, it's a very sincere question. We appoint you to this position. Can you be objective in the decisions you reach and the counsel you provide the governor when it comes to your dealings with TransCanada or any other individual company?
Well, thank you for the question, Representative Hawker. I think that the counsel given to the governor at various points along the way is something that will probably stay between he and I. I think that's an important question that you're asking, and one that's important particularly in light of some of the other things that we're dealing with, not only in this building, but in this state. And in terms of my association with TransCanada, it has always been and always will be purely through the state. I don't have any personal financial ties or connections in that regard. And I know firsthand the manner in which they approach their business and the way they've been approaching that business on behalf of us through the partnership that the state has enjoyed with TransCanada. Does that mean that everything has been perfect? No. And have there been instances, opportunities, if you will, for us to question that relationship and potentially reconsider it? Yes, there have. And there will be again, depending upon the course that the legislature sets for us here. The memorandum of understanding that exists between us is going to require further agreement and further consideration. And, you know, the specific gates we're going to go through are big ones, and we need to do them. We need to proceed with our eyes wide open. TransCanada certainly has impressed me with their performance to date, and I think that there are limitations to their ability to help the state of Alaska. I can tell you for myself that if all we were talking about was the monetization of Prudhoe and Point Thompson, and we didn't have any other real concerns or considerations in this equation, I don't think we would need TransCanada just as a partner purely from a financial perspective. What I think really drives my interest in seeing them a part of this transaction is the ability to bring additional gas producers, gas players to the table to move our resource through the infrastructure. I hope I'm answering your question, but I'd be happy to go further if you'd like to pursue it.
Follow-up, Representative Hawker. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, no, you didn't. I would characterize the response I received as sort of a defense of your relationship mm-hmm. with TransCanada and, you know, players along the way here. And the question, and I think the record would show, was, do you think if we confirm your nomination to this position of Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, can you be objective in your dealings with TransCanada and any other individual commercial party? Very different question.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Hawker. You're right. Can I be objective? I think the experiences we have with any company inform our decisions. Absolutely they do. And I think the challenge is to try and be objective. What are the objective measures you can use to evaluate any given proposal or opportunity dealing with any company? And I think that really is something that we have an obligation to fulfill when considering proposals, whether they be to the governor or to all of you, is to look for those external benchmarks. How do we know that we are in fact delivering value or providing the right opportunities to move the state forward? And it's something that I personally look for in all of the transactions, if you will, that we pursue. We're going to be talking about, I hope, a royalty sale contract for oil in a little bit. We have some things that we have to look at there. We try to be objective in considering those things. So objectivity is something that I think has to come, but not with blinders. You have to be able to take into account the experiences of dealing with any party in order to make sure you've got the right features, the right terms, and the right conditions. And I would contrast that with our pursuit of the settlement at Point Thompson, the litigation that had put a cloud on the title of the gas there. And the construct for that particular settlement required that we keep certain things in mind and identify clear benchmarks for the initial development of the field as well as commitments for further development afterwards. So in that particular case, we had to take into account the context, the history of our relationship as a state with the operator, and I think that's something we need to do in each particular case.
I've got a feeling I'm going to say this, but I've got a feeling he wants you to say yes or no. I can handle it.
Respectfully, Madam Chair, we've received a very thorough answer in Mr. Balash's own words, and I simply am processing in my own head that I did not get a very clear yes or no to that answer, and I wouldn't ask him to go any further, ma'am.
I'm happy to do that. I can be objective. I believe that I have been, and I think that part of the decision-making process that we all go through, it's, you know, informed by our own experiences is just the point I was trying to add to it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on the comments about roads on the North Slope, one of the criteria has been the demolition, removal, remediation. Are you interested in negotiations with the North Slope Borough or any municipality or entity that has surface land areas and trying to get at end of project life a takeover of roads that are built instead of requiring DRNR automatically in any leases or any development that we've got?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, I think the point you're raising is a good one, and the role that this infrastructure will play after the oil has been recovered is one that I think we're going to look hard at the local communities, the local governments that are most directly impacted or affected. And the DRNR provisions specifically embedded in our leases require the lessee to return the property to a condition acceptable to the commissioner at the time of abandonment. And so where I think there may be opportunities for a severing of that easement, that particular road, from the rest of the obligation, certainly can be explored up front and made permanent here and now, but there are practical limitations on doing that up front, and ones that I think in order to preserve the specific obligation under the lease, you got to be real careful not to inadvertently absolve the lessee from those other obligations.
And follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
And so I'm just trying to get a little better handle on that. I'm not saying we should just absolve those from leases, but are you talking with the surface owners to find out if there is interest in preserving those assets that are on the surface so that we, or do you see it as within the commissioner's authority to, at the time, at a future time, to not do the DRNR, even though it was a part of the lease, or is that something that needs to be also negotiated in future leases that say the commissioner may negotiate those terms for, surface facilities if it's acceptable to the municipality or the state?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, in most cases up on the North Slope in particular, we are dealing with the surface owner and the subsurface owner are the same, being ourselves. Where I think we're most of our dialogue lately with the North Slope Borough with regard to surface questions have been trying to get them additional acres to fulfill their municipal entitlement. That's been a struggle and continues to be one. Where we are dealing with split estate issues, and I think probably we deal with more often than not in your neck of the woods down in the peninsula, the situations vary depending on who the surface owner is. But certainly from a municipal standpoint, the opportunity to sort out along with the munis how to pursue that DRMR is something I would hope future commissioners take into account. My goal would be that as commissioner, we don't see a lot of abandonment going on. But we want to make sure that when it happens with the long term in mind. And in many cases, preserving pads, preserving roads is something that can be and should be viewed favorably in most cases, as long as they're clean.
Okay. Any other? Oh, yeah. Sure, but what, you want to follow up?
It can be another question after okay. others have.
Representative Kavasaki.
Thanks. And I also have a couple questions, but if folks have other questions, I'll just refrain to a couple at a time. But first, a story that in 1992, 100 young kids traveled to camp. It was Boys State, sponsored by the American Legion. And Joe and I were in the same cabin where we ended up fighting it out for mayor. I ended up winning that one, by the way.
Thought that worked out for you.
we as a cabin took over the cabin next to us as well so that we could create a huge voting block, and we came up with a silly name and took over the rest of the cabins by sheer force.
And I just thought, trying to take over the world.
Exactly. And I just knew that eventually we'd be around in the same place and same relationship. And a lot of those students are still around in policy places all across the state. But anyhow, just a story. But back to questions. In 2006 and 2007, I guess it was, part of the signature part of the AGEA legislation had to do with basin control and who owns the basin. And I'll read the excerpt, and this is from your predecessor, Tom Irwin, when he was talking about an independent open access pipeline, that if you were the producer, if I were the producer, I might be troubled with that too, referring to the issue of access and issue of basin control. If I were a producer, I might have those same trouble too if I wanted to control Alaska's gas basin. And that was quoted by Tom Irwin. And I'm wondering, and this is something that you brought up too as the governor's staff liaison for the Gas Line Inducement Act. And I'm just curious if your position on that has changed. If so, why? And can you give us just a little rundown?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. The concerns that I think all of us should have around basin control remain, and they're ones that I continue to be on guard against and looking for solutions to overcome. And our challenges in that regard are more difficult on the oil side than on the gas side, in part because we're starting fresh, so to speak, on the gas front. I think some of the things that we've done and included in the Heads of Agreement have come in no small part to realization because of the battles that have been fought in the past. And I think that the other companies, the other sponsor companies in question, don't particularly want to have those fights. They want to find solutions as well. And where I think our challenge is on the oil side is really how to see the next wave of development occur in a way that truly is efficient without and by that I mean the amount of resource that's in place on the slope, even in the fields that are currently producing, is mind-boggling. And ordinarily what you see in a given basin is a transition like we're seeing in Cook Inlet, where big legacy fields, big legacy assets that were owned by supermajors have now been consolidated in the hands of Hilcorp. And Hilcorp is going in with a technical eye and paying attention to the little bits and stringing them together to result in what I think is a pretty impressive turnaround in production in Cook Inlet. And our challenge on the North Slope is I'm not sure we can afford to go all the way through that cycle and transition in the same way, because the infrastructure on the slope is so big and so expensive that I'm not sure you can really achieve that. And so we've got to find a different way to bring in those smaller operators, some of those private players who can come in and do the things that the big guys either aren't interested in or can't attract the kind of capital within their own companies to invest in. And that's going to require a dialogue. It's going to require a working relationship with those incumbent companies. And I hope that I hope that we can continue to maintain a positive yet respectful dialogue with those incumbents.
Can I have a clarifying question?
Oh, follow-up, Representative
Costa. Just a clarifying question on the independents and how you would improve relationship with the smaller players and independents in order to get more oil down the pipeline. Was that? Can you just elaborate?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I think we have a tendency in our circles to overgeneralize and use the word independence to refer to anybody who's not one of the big three, Conoco, BP, or Exxon. And, you know, one of the problems with that overgeneralization is that we lump all those other companies into one pot, call them independents, and then think about the treatment any one of them receives is the treatment that all of them receive. And something that I have struggled with a great deal in my time as deputy and now as commissioner is dealing with companies who have great ideas and great motivations and very thin checkbooks. They're not able to live up to the commitments that they make in the course of unit agreements and development plans. And I, you know, that's unfortunate because I think those kinds of opportunities are the ones that are most prevalent on the slope today. Now, I can contrast that with the commitments and activities and follow through from Repsol in particular. That's a company that doesn't have a problem writing a check for the commitments they make. And I've seen them actually, you know, come in and fulfill drilling obligations in units that were made at the same time other companies made commitments that have not been fulfilled. And so that's something that we're working hard to try and rectify in terms of understanding the circumstances under which it's okay to enter into some sort of a unit agreement, which is not very often, before a well has been drilled and we know what the hydrocarbon looks like underground. So not sure if that's the complete picture, but you know, we are working with those non-incumbents, I think, is a better way to say it rather than just the label independence. But we're having to work harder and harder at identifying when somebody's actually capable of doing the things they're telling us they're going to do.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Just a brief follow-up, then I'll pass. I have a couple of questions, other questions. Do you know the name Tom Kelly?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I do. He was the gentleman who helped identify our selections on the slope.
Yeah, thanks. And it's a little bit of history, but there was more of that Tom Kelly story. He was the first Natural Resources Commissioner under Governor Hickel. Hickel was looking for an oil man, somebody that knew the business, knew how to work with the other folks, the other industry folks. Got his degree, master's degree from Texas A&M, worked for Continental Oil, ended up working for his stepfather in Texas before Hickel pulled him to the state of Alaska to become Commissioner of Natural Resources. And it's you know, it's a really interesting part of history because we're sort of at that point in time today when we deal with natural gas. And Kelly viewed his public service as a challenge. After being appointed by Hickel, he said, "When you're dealing with the public resources, the resource, the highest price is the fairest price. That's because as a state official, you have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize the state's value of its resources," was what he ended up saying. This is Crude Dreams, an old history book. I want you to just respond to what that statement means to you.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the highest price is the fairest price is, I think, a pretty good rule to live by. It's one that when we're talking about our share of the oil, what we're talking about is our royalty interest. How do we maximize that value? How do we get the highest price we can for that royalty share? And that's something that I struggle with in dealing with my hometown. Right now, people are clamoring for reductions in the price of our royalty barrels with the thinking that that will somehow result in reductions in the price of heating oil or gasoline or will keep the refinery operating. And that's something that I can't just look at that narrow window and narrow constituency in order to fulfill my obligations on this particular job. The challenge really is to get the highest dollar I can for the resource that we own and manage. So one thing that I do hear a lot of confusion on, though, is when we talk about our share, are we talking about our share that we have as a derivation of our ownership, which is the royalty interest? Or are we talking about our share that comes about through the course of the production tax? And I sometimes joke with my colleagues over at the Department of Revenue, and I say this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but frankly, taxing is stealing. Royalty is what we get by virtue of ownership. Taxing is what we do with the force of law, and, you know, we do it because we can. And I don't mean to say that in any sense that production taxes are bad, but we have to be very careful in how we assess those taxes as a state, because it does ultimately impact our royalty interest, our ownership interest. And that's where I think, you know, this body has struggled with that question. I myself have struggled with that question over the course of these past couple of years. You know, I think we've worked our way to a pretty good spot, all in all.
Just one note.
Representative Seaton, you go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering your perspective when we are looking at public involvement in the public process on the use of our assets, whether that's agriculture leases, whether that's mariculture, whether that's oil and gas, all of the permits that are required. You know, we've been through a series of reduction in public process, whether it was coastal zone or potentially at House Bill 77, those kind of things. I want to know your perspective on what you think the state should have as far as involvement on public in those issues.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the challenge when you're dealing with the management of these public lands is striking the sweet spot between things that are routine and those things that really are unique. And you know, there's a pretty bright line that exists between a disposal, where you're actually selling somebody the land or giving them a very long-term interest, and things that are short-term in nature that aren't going to have a permanent or long-lasting effect on the resource in question. And I think that certainly having transparency to what we do at DNR in granting permits and authorizations is an important step. But the question that I think we have to do is really focus on the tools available to us today. A lot of our processes are rooted in, you know, 20 and 30-year-old, even longer, systems and methods of noticing the public and making people aware of what we're doing. I can tell you that the speed at which the public can engage on a topic has changed dramatically, and yet, despite that speed, despite the prevalence of email and everything else, I can tell you I run into people who are upset that they didn't know a permit was going to be granted. They didn't know that a project was going to be proceeding in this particular part of their neighborhood. And, you know, I think for me, certainly, when we're talking about a disposal, more is better in terms of that engagement with the public, engagement with public hearings and so forth. But I do think there are the routine things that we can generalize and we can routinize in a way that we know what the best practices are, we know where it makes sense for these things to take place or not, and we can trust our resource managers to really identify those and apply those kind of rules of thumb in a specific way. And actually, I think there are some things in HB 77 that, in an odd sort of way, actually require more public notice than we presently have for some of those key and routine authorizations.
And just
follow up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Well, I want to know your philosophy on things like the temporary water use permits being sequentially offered so that something that doesn't have much public input now becomes the possible permitting section for an entire length of a project. Before, it was a 5-year short window, what you were talking about, fairly quick, not really something that involves a whole lot, but now we're talking about changing that so they can be multiple ones and sequentially on the same project on the same amount. So I guess I'm trying to figure out where your balance is as far as converting from a water right permit for a project for the life of the project versus using temporary water permits to actually accomplish that without public process.
The chair, Representative Seaton, I know that the issue's gotten an awful lot of attention here in the last couple of years. And ultimately, it might not be up to me how much public involvement there is or isn't as we go through the final stages, hopefully, of House Bill 77's development. But in terms of something that is temporary, like a temporary water use permit, I'm not so sure that we need to have a big public process that requires a long lead time in order to get to yes. Where I think I would be a little more anxious about that is if all we were talking about was a water use permit for a project to go forward, and if there weren't other activities, other permits, other reviews that were going on, I would probably want to see more involvement publicly, notice-wise, public comment-wise, on those temporary water use permits. I think the big questions get answered in different places more often than not, certainly having some sort of public access, public listing where people could find out what the water use permits are in an area is something that can happen. They're all public records, but I'm not sure that we need to go through a newspaper notice or a post office notice, you know, for every one of those. Honestly, I don't think that would be an efficient use of state resources or the public's bandwidth.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been noodling when to ask this question. I think it's probably as good as any. We passed a GIA. It didn't work for BP and Conoco, so they went out and did their own Denali project. Not very long, I think before that actually, Exxon became partners with TC in the AGEA process. So now we have Exxon and TC and Exxon, BP, and Conoco and the state. So help me understand the relationship that exists there. You know, I'm not going to knock Exxon, but it looks to me like they're getting more. They've got a portion of TC's involvement in AGEA. We've got our proportion, which we're prepared to contract away a certain amount to TC and Exxon. So help me understand the relationship of that contractual agreement as it relates to what we're doing today and your philosophy. And then I'm going to end it with, why don't you just declare AGEA non-economic and let's start off with the best partners we can go get. Maybe TransCanada is that one, but I'm not sure TransCanada Exxon is the best partner we could have in that project. So help me understand the relationship there and what goes forward, and maybe you know a lot more, and maybe you can't even tell me what you know.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think the steps that were taken by ExxonMobil in particular in 2009 to align with TC and the AGEA framework were critical. And I think it's important to note that they didn't take on all of the AGEA obligations. They didn't fully become part of the license. They aligned closely with the licensee in a commercial relationship. And what that did was provided an opportunity, a dialogue, to take place where they were prepared to acknowledge the state had certain key interests that were critical to the state's long-term goals surrounding resource development and commercialization of ANS gas in particular. I don't think it's... I have a hard time imagining getting to where we are today, or even where we got on the Point Thomson settlement, without that alignment having taken place, because it opened a dialogue, and one that was lacking, frankly, up until that point in time. If you think about 2007, 2008, I think we all know the history there. it really was in 2009 that a genuine conversation got started about how to advance our interests at the same time recognizing the interests and key factors that would affect decision-making on the part of one of the lessees, and in this case, the one that holds the largest working interest in natural gas on the North Slope. As far as our current relationship with the licensee and ExxonMobil, somewhere last year in the course of these concept selection agreements that exist between all the parties, that relationship broadened out to include BP and Conoco. And at this point in time, the AGEA license I would describe as a vehicle of convenience for everybody. It's helped keep everybody together and moving along in a path that works for all of us. And we've been able to line out a path forward that allows us to step out of that license that really is, as I described, a vehicle of convenience at this point, and move into a new construct, a new framework that fully recognizes all of the interests that everybody has here going forward. And one thing that I am not clear on is you referenced a contract with Exxon and TC, and I'm not entirely sure I understand what you're referring to there.
And it is that commercial agreement where they align themselves with TC, and I believe the chairman of TransCanada said no one's happy unless Exxon's happy. I believe that was quoted a couple of days after that. So I guess to cut to the chase in the future, what does it mean? Do we have a partnership with the state, Exxon, BP, and Conoco? The state's portion of that contract includes TC and their partner Exxon, or not? So, I want to get to, is Exxon double dipping here? I mean, what kind of arrangement do they have? Are they going to end up with 7% of our 14%, or, where is it? Help me understand.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I am not aware of any side deals or anything else between TC and ExxonMobil with regard to the equity interest that is represented by the state's gas share in the heads of agreement. If I
follow up, Representative Johnson,
and maybe just to direct, not follow up, but they had some kind of commercial agreement, and that's under AGEA.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct,
and that is the law of the land still.
That is correct.
So, somewhere, the state is partnered with Exxon and TC in this deal, in our one quarter of the percentage. Now, what percentage Exxon and TC have talked about, that's the commercial agreement that you probably wouldn't know about and I wouldn't know about. So that's kind of what I'm getting at. Are we partnering with Exxon and TC as for our quarter, at which we give up negotiation rights? And there's a lot of things in there that our seat at the table is taken over by what I believe is Exxon and TC right now, and we give up a certain portion. So are we giving up that negotiation power to Exxon, TC? Exxon, what portion? How's it work? And have we even looked at that as a state yet?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the partnership with Exxon, BP, and Conoco to get to our quarter is embodied in that heads of agreement.
Right.
As far as who we partner with then further on our 25% is a function of the agreement with TC in the body of that MOU. I am not aware of any further dilution or interest that ExxonMobil might have in or through TransCanada for, you know, the midstream interest there in the project. And
If I, Madam Chair,
yeah,
maybe this is a thing for another point.
Well, this might be something that, as we pursue the regular, you know, but is it possible that they would have a part of that and you wouldn't know about it because you don't know what their other agreement is?
Through the chair, or Madam Chair, the agreement that aligned those two parties in 2009, the interim project agreement, is one that the state did have access to, did review ahead of time. Associated with it was the project funding agreement. And that agreement specifically was in place to identify how the parties were going to pay for their respective shares of work under the license in order to fulfill the license, even though the work was being conducted by legally an entity that was not the licensee. So, you know, we saw those agreements, we're familiar with them, but if there have been further agreements between ExxonMobil and TransCanada, TransCanada has an obligation to tell us about them. And we've not been informed of any other agreement along those lines. Now, over time, as the concept selection agreements were struck and subsequently BP and Conoco got involved, there were some refinements made to the way reimbursements flowed, but that's, you know, that's something we've continued to monitor and be kept apprised of.
And my question or my comment would be, have you actually asked about that?
I'll pick up the phone and do that this evening.
That was my question.
Representative Olson.
I'm a little confused. We have two TCs in play right now, though, don't we? Seriously.
We did, yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Olson, yes, as a matter of which corporate entity is playing which role, that's correct.
And your previous comments would apply to both of the TCs.
My previous comments with regard to relationships with ExxonMobil.
We're using TC in the singular.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. In those previous comments, I was referring to TC Alaska, which is the entity, the Alaska U.S. entity, that is the licensee.
Now I'm really confused, but thanks.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
You know what I'd like to do? I would like to open up public testimony in case there's somebody online. So what I'm going to do is open up public testimony. Is there anyone online that would like to testify? Hearing none, is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Then I will close public testimony. And what is the will of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Madam, and I really do appreciate the latitude you've given all of us in the dialogues. I think, you know, some of it went to questions that are really beyond the scope of actually the confirmation process here, but, you know, they're still relevant to our concerns. And I would say I can't help but be concerned about that comment of calling the AGEA license a vehicle of convenience. I might suggest, how about an inconvenient vehicle of questionable necessity? Madam, in all sincerity, I would move that the committee forward the name of Joe Balash, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, to the joint legislative session for formal confirmation. And again, noting that our moving this name forward does not in any way imply or suggest either support for or against Mr. Balash in the final vote on the floor of the legislature.
Manager.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this is out of order now that there's a motion, but because we only have bills previously scheduled or heard on Wednesday, would it be possible to have Commissioner Designee Balash back before us for a few more questions?
When?
On Wednesday.
There's a motion on the table.
Let's get this taken care of first.
Madam Chair, I guess procedurally that would be an objection to the motion, and we would have a vote on the motion.
You want she's not doing that, so.
Well, you don't know that.
Are you objection?
Brief at ease for a moment.
Brief at ease.
Okay.
Okay. And you're not going to object. Okay. And so hearing no objection, your motion has moved. And having said that, Joe, congratulations on getting that far. And and so I do want to mention also that we're running over, but on Wednesday we will have another meeting. We will take up House Bill 287 at that time, and Representative Hawker will be presiding at that meeting.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
We need to at least present the bill
I
so
asked
we could do
about
bill
that.
Previously heard.
I asked about that and was given a...
It's previously noticed.
Yeah.
Previously noticed.
Yeah, because I asked about that. I wanted to make sure myself.
And
okay.
Madam Chair, again, just a point. I'd suggest Representative Tarr, I'm sure Mr. Balash would avail himself to come speak with you anytime.
All right. Having said all that, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, ma'am.